Hi and welcome. This is Dave. I wanted to begin by the follow-up that I promised last time and sent the attached page called Neural Conditioning to Make Changes That Last, the Neural Conditioning Work Chart, to you and explain that a bit and then see if there are any questions about that. You'll see the four columns. And the way that, let me tell you the way that I devised this and the situation that occurred for me to devise it, and I've kind of refined it since, but it's the same essence of the idea. I was working in executive mentor coaching with an executive woman who was doing great, having a terrific success at her business, and noticed that whenever she would go home for a major holiday. Could I get a mute, please, for background noise? I'd like to keep it open for discussion, if we could. Okay, I've obviated the background noise with putting it in presentation mode. She would have a really difficult time when she went home for a major holiday, like a Thanksgiving or a Christmas, and noticed that she could kind of hold things together for almost a day, but then after that it would kind of wear thin, and she would inevitably end up in fights with her parents and have just a really difficult time in dealing with everyone in her family, and it was a reversion back to an earlier time. And I asked her, that was one of the first questions, when you get into that situation and your state changes, how old do you feel inside? What's the age of that conversation? She said it's exactly like when I was 13 and 14. So what I did then was to recommend to her to schedule a time for herself to set aside 30 minutes where she would get really grounded and centered and reflect on, observe what happened in those instances when she would get triggered, and to list all of the emotional cues, the emotional triggers, to list them, not to get caught up in them, not to have that be state changing, but to be aware of each of the cues that she noticed. And this was something like a particular way that her dad would roll his eyes, a phrase that her mother kept repeating, something her sister would do. There were just a number of things, and by the time she did this and spent some time, she had like 14 or 15 things that were absolutely triggering her that would instantly be state-changing, that would set her in motion. And what she also did at my recommendation during that time was to write down what each trigger would cue her to respond, the state change that moved into her usual behavior, the second column. Whatever that cue was that would instantly change her state of mind, that she would be 13 again and be in that behavior mode or that attachment pattern, and to write that down. What this did, it was not to focus on the negative, but to cue her radar to be aware of all the things that would be triggering and that would cause state changes, so that she could be aware and recognize them rather than be caught up in the action sequence, that she could be an observer of it and be self-reflective and empathic with herself. I suggested at a second time, a second setting, another 30 minutes, that she look at how she wanted to get centered and grounded, how she wanted to regulate her state of mind. And that involves a mantra, a three-part component of getting grounded and centered, which would be a cue, like something that she would do, some movement or just touching her finger in a certain way, whatever it would be. Mine, before I do a presentation, is to put my index finger and thumb together on both hands to have two little circles, and to put them together in the middle to have a little infinity sign. A focus, which is a phrase that she would say to herself. What I say before a keynote is relaxed and powerful. And then to, at the same time of doing this, to breathe in a deep breath of relaxation and to breathe out any tension, and to do that a couple of times. So when I do that before a keynote, it takes 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, and I'm in an optimum state. For her, it was to be sure she gets grounded and centered, and then to have pre-planned what her ideal response or behavior would be, so that she can ultimately rewire her brain to move that emotional trigger to be something that creates an ideal response to that trigger, rather than getting stuck in column two. Now, this is a hard work miracle. It takes repetition of doing this and doing it over and over until it actually rewires your brain. But in the first holiday, she noticed that she had tremendous success doing this. And she gave me a follow-up, even though we weren't working together in the following year. By the next holiday, she was able to go through the entire time in a very pleasant, very different kind of behavior pattern. Now, I've done the same thing with an executive who's having trouble with another executive and is cued in certain ways. So whatever the emotional trigger is, to have someone be aware of it and what their usual state change behavior, the response is, then to look at how they can get centered by regulating a state of mind. Remember, focus and physiology are the two most powerful ways, and to create a cue for that. And then to have pre-planned an ideal response or ideal behavior. So I want to go off of lecture mode and ask you again to manage the background noise, because I want to have a discussion briefly before we move into neuromarketing to see if this makes sense to you. Any thoughts or questions about the explanation and about the neural condition chart? Does this make sense to you? I will take that as a yes. Any questions that you have, or clarifications about anything that that I mentioned? Anything else any of you would like to discuss? Questions or comments or things that you'd like us to discuss before moving into the seminar topic today?
You're just so great at explaining and teaching that there's no questions.
Oh, okay. That's a very nice reframing. Thank you. I'm gonna plagiarize that. Anything else that any of you would like to discuss before moving into the topic? Well, I'll put us on lecture mode, and we're going to talk about neuromarketing then. Okay. I want to ask you 4 questions and think about your answer to each of these 4 questions. Do you earn your living trying to convince others to purchase goods or services? Do you work for yourself or run your own operation, even if part-time? Does your work require elastic skills, the ability to cross boundaries and functions, to work outside your specialty and to do a variety of different things throughout the day? And 4, do you work in education, training, or healthcare? If your answer is yes to any one of these 4 questions, you're a salesperson. And I say that so that we can talk about that without it being something negative, because there's usually a negative connotation about being in sales. And I want to expand that and reframe that. When we teach or train people, we want to move them to part with their resources, their time, attention, effort. And if they do, we will bring value, and they will be better off at the end of the engagement. Teachers sell their students that the science lesson they're teaching is the most interesting thing ever. In healthcare, the physical therapist helps someone recover from injury to handle resources, time, attention, effort, because patients can be healthy and healthier if they use those resources wisely. To move people effectively and powerfully requires seeing them as a participant and a collaborator, and that's really key. So here's what happens when you don't do that. People consult a physician when they're afraid or when they're in pain. fewer than 50% of people who get a prescription from their doctor actually fill it. Now, this is people who are motivated by being scared and being in pain to see a physician. Of those who do fill it, fewer than 50% take it as the doctor directed. So when someone is motivated by fear and pain, inconvenienced by time and travel, and have to pay to consult an expert, less than 25 actually follow that expert advice. Now, consider this question for yourself. What percent of real work involves convincing or persuading people to give up something they value for something we have, something that will bring them great value? Almost 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed to answer that question. Nearly everyone, way over 90%, considered this aspect of their work the most critical component of professional success. Yet while most people believe direct persuasion is crucial for professional success, the time allocated to engaging and directly persuading people was extremely low, in the low single digits. What we find valuable and what we actually do may be significantly different. When we work for ourselves and we're entrepreneurs, we become salespeople as well. What people in sales do is move people. The persuasion industry, led by neuromarketing, is attuned to influencing everything we buy. What we purchase is for both emotional as well as intellectual reasons, and most often our choices have been influenced in ways so subtle that we may have even failed to recognize them. An example of a failure in influence. A cigar manufacturer spent considerable money on an ad that depicted a smiling woman handing out cigars to her husband and his friends. This was attractively done and widely displayed. A lot of money put into this. The result, a dramatic fall in cigar sales. Well, why was this? Men smoke cigars because in doing so, they unconsciously feel dominant and important. By showing a woman encouraging a man to smoke and being subservient to her offering, the advertisement was psychologically neutering the company's male customers, so it worked in the opposite direction than they wanted. So here are some misconceptions about selling. I asked my good buddy, Art Wilson, who flew to Houston to take me to dinner as soon as he found out that I had completed my training and coaching and in transition from my psychoanalytic practice, to tell me that he had taken five people in different parts of the country to dinner to pick their brains to do what he was doing when he got ready to leave a senior executive position at IBM and start his consulting practice. So what he did was to find two misconceptions. Now this is a guy, and we currently co-founded and do the What's Next Exec Retreats. And he was for several years the number one person in IBM's group of over 10,000 sales professionals. Here are the two biggest misconceptions about sales that he passed on. One, selling is a natural gift. A huge misconception. For more than 90% of people, including the most successful salesperson, this isn't true. Somebody may do the right thing for the right reason, but it has to be combined with the right style and the right emotion. Selling is not a natural gift. This guy who was number one of 10,000 professional salespeople in IBM for 3 years in a row, number one, said selling is not a natural gift. He said, Dave, I didn't have a natural gift. I had to work at it. Second, and this is huge for me, this is the second misconception. The best salespeople have no call reluctance. He said, Dave, I hate to get on phone. I said, all right, why didn't you tell me this a long time ago? Over 90% of the best salespeople have call reluctance, but they do it anyhow by getting in the optimum state of mind and sticking to their plan. Pick people you want to reach out to and do it. You don't have to be motivated, but you do have to have a plan and stick to it. And shrink the change, what we do in coaching all the time, a designated number of calls per day. So consider these two questions. If the person you're selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? when your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? If the answer to either of these questions is not a resounding yes, you need to recalibrate. So let's look at the 1%. Now, this is in your outline. Professor Harold Cope teaches law and emphasizes that in an attempt to understand the law or an understanding just about anything, the key is to focus on the 1%. To not get lost in the details, but to think about the essence of what's really important, the 1% that gives life to the other 99%. Understanding that 1%, and especially being able to explain it to others, is the hallmark of a strong mind and a strong position. The 1% is the essence of clarity, whether you're selling a product or service or trying to convince anyone of anything. What's the 1%? When you can answer that question, when you can answer that question about your coaching practice or your coaching firm and convey it to others in 10 words or less, they're likely to be moved. Einstein said, if you can't state your position simply, you don't understand it well enough. Seth Godin was even a little bit more terse. If you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. And he used 8 words. I thought I was being pretty generous because my neuroscientist research collaborator says 10 words. The purpose of a 1%, and think of the purpose of a pitch, is not necessarily to move someone else to adopt your idea. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. The other person begins being a participant to eventually arrive at an outcome that appeals to both of us. Remember for your hub statement, the ideal response is, tell me more. You've begun a conversation. You don't have to squeeze everything into 10 words. So here are 3 common types of pitches. One is the one-word pitch. Now, that really shrinks it down. Listen up for that. What is the one characteristic that you most want associated with your name, your business, your brand? A one-word equity. When anyone thinks of you, they associate that word. When anyone says that word, they think of you. What do you think of when you think of Nike? Either swoosh or performance, one or the other. One word. What technology company do you think of when you hear the word search? What credit card company comes to mind when you hear the word priceless? You know, unless you're in a handmade log cabin in the middle of the woods, Google and MasterCard should come to mind. In his 2012 reelection campaign, President Obama built his entire strategy around one word, forward. A second is the question pitch. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was running for president of the U.S. in a very grim economy. He simply asked a question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? The question was designed to make people work a bit harder, especially to come up with their own reasons for agreeing or not. When people come up with their own reasons for agreeing or believing something, they endorse the belief more strongly and become more likely to act on it. So that's why we want to ask questions, to get people to think about and come up with their answers. They're going to sign in far more vigorously when that's the case. A third is the Twitter pitch. Brief, simple, specific. A micro message of 140 or fewer characters. Notice all three of these have one theme, and these are not just my notions. These are ones that are garnered from all of neuromarketing research. These three are the most common, and they all share brevity, simplicity, and clarity. 140 or fewer characters. The mark of an effective tweet, like an effective pitch, is that it engages recipients and encourages them to take the conversation further. And further may be responding, sharing a tweet, clicking a link, or if it's a conversation, saying, tell me more. Readers assign the highest rating to tweets that ask questions of followers. This confirms again the power of questions to engage and to persuade. And remember what questions they get someone to focus. So it aligns the energy field of someone's brain. So let's talk about listening to learn now. And first, preparation. Three key questions will help you prepare your pitch, however you think about it. You may not think about it as pitch. Whichever of the above three varieties that you choose or even lean toward, you will clarify your purpose and strategy by making sure that you can answer these questions. However you design it, whatever your style is, these are the three questions. After someone hears your pitch, first question, what do you want them to know? What do you want them to feel? And third, what do you want them to do? The end should be in mind in the beginning. Then, before you connect with a prospect, write down these four things. Before you connect with somebody, this may be a call, this may be a conversation. Let's say it's a call. If this call is successful, what are the next best actions for that person and for me to take after the call? For that person and for me. Now, if it's not a call, think of it as whatever the engagement is, a conversation. What are the next best actions for that person and for me? This is pre-planned because you're designing the end, so you're going to back into it. Two, what would be the highest value objective of a client for that call? What would we talk about, and what would be the highest value for that client? Three, what are some good questions to ask the prospect? And four, what are some additional possible topics for the call if we have time? Now, the secret here, these are questions for Mark Wilson. This is how he became the number one salesman 3 years in a row until he moved on to an executive position for IBM out of 10,000 salespeople. This is his protocol, and he gave me permission to share it with you. For most people, the opposite of talking isn't listening, it's waiting. When others are speaking, we usually divide our attention between what they're saying now and what they're going to say next, and we wait until we can squeeze in what we really want to say. The result is a mediocre halfway position on both. Some professionals don't even bother to wait. A typical study found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds that they begin to speak during an appointment. This often prevents the patient from describing what brought him or her into the office in the first place, but especially it keeps them from telling their story. And that's why people are not real satisfied with a lot of physicians. They don't get to tell their story. Here's an example of listening differently. Suppose you're raising money for charity and ask somebody to contribute $200. Well, she says no, but she's more likely to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't give $200. Okay, consider that an offer. Perhaps she can donate a smaller amount. Or she might say, no, I can't give right now. Well, consider that as an offer as well. The obvious move is to focus on the right now and ask when might be a better time. Or even to consider the entire sentence as an offer, perhaps to contribute to your charity in some other way, such as being a volunteer. This way to hear offers, which comes in all shapes and sizes, is to change the way you listen and change the way you respond. Consider hearing everything that's said as an offer and to respond to the offer component. Two principles of listening and negotiating. Convert yes but to yes and. The idea is not to win, but to learn. So when both parties view an encounter as an opportunity to learn, the desire to sell really fades in the background. It's a non-issue. It's a different mindset of collaboration and engagement. When we move from selling to serving, we engage the recipient as a collaborator and become empathically attuned to the needs and to our effectiveness in benefiting that person. This non-sales selling is the ability to influence, to persuade, and to change behavior while striking a balance between what others want and what you can provide. We elicit from people what their specific goals are and frame what we do to help them achieve those goals. It's what we do in coaching every day, every session. So there are three phases then of sales mastery. And I want to talk about each of the three. These are in your outline. Engage, enroll, and create conviction. Let's talk about engaging. This engaging is to connect and create interest. And this really applies social and emotional intelligence. So let's think about it in terms of the story. Equally important to your story is your hero. Who is the hero of your story? Heroes come in all varieties. Teller, listener, customer, product, location, and tribe. The hero needs to fit the goal. Let me tell you a little bit more about what I mean by that. Stories involve the art of the tell, and they involve the hero, the character in the story who gives the audience a point of view. All the passion in the world won't do any good unless we have some place to put it. That's where the hero comes in. The hero serves as the reader's guide and surrogate. Let's talk about it in terms of stories now and as we read. The hero is the character that the reader or the listener identifies with. If the audience experiences the story through the hero and the story leads the hero to embrace a call to action, then your audience will automatically hear your call to action as well. The hero is the person, the place, the product, or brand that enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. I'm going to give you some examples in just a minute. In every story, there's one person who can make the difference. That's the hero, the character the reader or viewer identifies with. Now, remember that we spoke of business stories, like novels and films, consisting of three parts: the challenge, the struggle, and the resolution. The hero faces the challenge and fights through to the resolution. The hero may sometimes seem surprisingly hard to pinpoint, but unless you do, you have no story. When people donate to a charitable cause, it's not to save the lives of tens of thousands of children, but the best story is how you can save one child. So you, the donor, gets to be the hero there. How do you make your client the hero for your professional engagement? We ask, what do you want to achieve? Where would you ideally like to be in a year? What constitutes an amazing achievement for you? Then, whatever it is, I'll help you get there. And this is the conversation we may have for the few minutes when a client calls us to talk about the possibility of mentor coaching. So there are six keys to preparation for exactly what I've just described. One, know who the client is and anticipate the pains and the needs. You don't have to be magic and know beforehand, but anticipate it so you can be listening for this and ask more about it. Two, know your product. If that's a service, then it's a service, and its advantages and benefits, and be able to say those in one sentence, by the way, too. Know your competition. Never engage in depreciating a competitor, but know what else is out there. Know the potential objections that someone may have, and have answers ready. That may be fee, that may be any number of things. Expect the best. Expect a state of positive expectation. And create demand. Six, for example, the client convinces himself or herself by your creating the demand. So, again, anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The hallmark of a true professional is the ability to manage a state of mind. Remember all that we talked about last time? And this, the preparation, the mantra, I spend a minute before receiving every call from every client getting totally focused, totally centered and grounded so that 100% of my attention is there and available and ready to engage with that client when that call comes in. So the keys to making effective contact: set specific goals. And secondly, be creative and fun and playful. Have fun at it. We take our work very seriously, but that doesn't say we can't have fun at it. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have a plan for what you're going to say. And even if someone doesn't purchase anything or get your services, they may refer to you. So everything you say is important. Do this in abundance to qualified contacts. The things, and this is something I mentioned to people when they start training with me, there's a requirement at CTA for 20 sample sessions. And that ideally results in at least 2 paying clients. Well, consider this. If you did 100 sample sessions, by the end of the training, you'd have 10 paying clients. And my bet would be that you'd even have more than that, because the more you do, the better you're going to get, and the more effective and better not only your conversion rate's going to be, but how you select who you give sample sessions to. So I've had people end the 22 weeks of training with me at CTA with 15 and 16 clients, nearly a full practice, or for some, a full practice. So that's some of the application of the key to making effective contact. The things that can stop you from making contact include not being prepared, not being in a peak state, or believing that you're an interruption. Now, to engage the client, connection and rapport are the foundation of all influence. Clients will choose you because they trust you, like you, and especially because they have confidence in you. And where is the best place, the number one place they get confidence in you? When you have confidence in yourself. This confidence is the belief that you can help them get what they want and need. Importantly, they will choose you because they believe you have their best interest at heart. What's important in selling is to establish this rapport and develop trust. The primary question, whose interest do you have in mind? The prospect needs trust and confidence. Caring people buy from caring people and will even help you close, as long as you have the prospect's best interest at heart. People want to feel cared for. We all want to be appreciated. People love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more, multiples of educators. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. And remember the law of reciprocation. Whatever you put out, it will come back many-fold. And that's either negative or positive. The second component of sales mastery, enroll. And this is how to qualify and discover your client's buying strategies. Probe for problems to qualify them. What are their challenges? And make sure they feel good about the service that you're offering. What are their needs, their interests, their challenges? Their real problems that we can help them solve. Highlight the problems and illuminate or resonate with the pain. This is what the client minimizes or denies. So here's some qualifying questions, and this is in your outline, because there are 5 components: needs, wants, wounds, authority, and money. And here's a sample question for you. Needs. What does the prospect really need? Wants. What does the prospect really want? Wounds. What are some of their needs, pains, and challenges? Authority. Do they have the authority to make the decision? And money, do they have the money? We often don't need to decide that. The professional, when you go to a doc, a dentist, a CPA, an attorney, they don't see if you have the money. They listen to what you say. They make a recommendation and tell you the fee. Focus changes state. What would be the best benefit to you of doing this? When someone imagines, it becomes real for them. If you told them, they wouldn't believe you. Remember, it needs to come from them. What is the best benefit of you doing this? This is the question to the client. Have them come up with an answer. Have them do the sales. Remember, facts and information are outside in, the outer circle of the brain, not the decision-making area. Number 1, ask questions. Paint a picture. Ask questions and they will get a real experience inside themselves and give real answers. Questions are the greatest asset. Questions empower you and the buyer by putting them in a state that makes things more congruent. Number two, for enrolling, do something very real. Sell with all five senses to give a full experience. Some of the highest paid people in this country are state changers, people that induce state changes. What sells? What sells is what puts someone in a better state. Here's an exercise. Every night for 10 nights, come up with three ideas about how you can get your clients to feel like they already own your product or service before even buying it. Think of creative and unique ways to do that consistently, or depending on your biorhythms, first thing in the morning. Now, you do that three each night or each day for 10 days. You come up with 30 things about how your client can feel like they already own your product even before buying it. Now, most of the 30 that you come up with may be goofy, but you only need one or two to change your business. An example, a realtor whose clients like a particular house they viewed but haven't really quite decided yet. He then orchestrates an entire meal catered to the family in the home they're considering. They have a fabulous meal and see the fresh flowers he brought in and can picture themselves in that home. His rate of closure, 80%, unheard of in the real estate industry. So also, model success. Find successful people and see what they do. My buddy Art's recommendation. They most likely will make the experience real using all five senses. If someone's eating food, they change their state, and that state change is linked to perceiving it as due to the object or the person. That's why so much business is done at lunches and dinners. The realtor changed the state of mind of the purchasers and linked pleasure and family togetherness with that house. He created a Rorschach that the family projected their hopes and their excitement onto, and then he sold them the Rorschach. Whatever is happening around someone, when they have a strong feeling, it will be linked. Now, it's not logical, but Pavlov's dog linked the bell with food and salivated, then only the bell was enough to cue the anticipation. So put people in an environment that creates the state you want to link to your product. An example, the Brilliant series, and I just heard they discontinued them and put them out to pasture, but anyhow, the Brilliant, in my view, series of Super Bowl Budweiser commercials of the dog and the Clydesdale, who are buddies. They induce a state of mind of connection and bonding and release oxytocin in the brain. Here's the best signal of a successful oxytocin release. Aww. The message goes right to your hippocampus to connect that experience with what? Budweiser. Another example. A new car smell that puts you in a state to buy a new car. BMW makes their brochures with a new car smell impregnated. And that was a little hard to believe. I bought my wife a new BMW for Christmas last Christmas. And it's right. The brochures smell like a new car. The total sensory and emotional experience with the salesperson, you, matters. Get creative. Brainstorm. There's always a way to make it real and effective. Three things. Ask questions. Create an experience. Point, tell, and paint. Create an image. You want a blank that will blank. Is that correct? You want an investment that will bring you security and income. Is that correct? Ask a question that will put their mind back on the problem. Point out the reason they're buying. Make it real for them to refocus. Paint to emphasize if all this came true. If you had a seminar for your people, what would be the most important thing they get out of it? If you have three results, what would those be? If you don't get those, what would it cost you? An example, in one of my offerings for a training program, If you had an internal mentoring program for your company, how would your people benefit? Ask questions. Don't tell them. Ask them. Ask how much effectiveness or success would you have if you did this. Don't tell them. Get them to tell you. An exercise, a second exercise I'd suggest. Write 5 questions to make it feel to the client that he or she already owns your product or service. 5 questions that make it feel to them that they already own your product or service. An example is the real estate agent showing a house. The agent doesn't ask you what you think about the living room, but instead asks where you would put your entertainment center. The agent wants you to have the experience as if you've already bought it and have already moved some of your stuff in. The third component to sales mastery, compel, create conviction. Remember, people don't buy facts, they buy benefits. And remember, too, selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they will get what they want. Conviction first starts with you, then to your client. You have to be convinced. You have to have a confidence and conviction. But if they have to buy or attend an event, but they have to buy or attend an event for their reasons, not yours, the number one way, give them the experience and conviction they will get what they want out of your product or service. The number two way, match to their number one value. For example, if it's freedom, show them how it will enhance their freedom. Find the dominant emotion for buying, even though the prospect will want to believe it's for logical reasons. Remember, we always buy emotionally and justify logically. So listen for their emotional reason. Do one feature at a time, not the whole load. Give prospects several units of conviction to justify buying. A unit of conviction has 7 parts. I don't expect you to remember this, but it's in the outline. A claim, you will. A fact, because. A benefit, which means to you. Another benefit, and that really means. And then evidence, and then permission to ask questions. My purpose at the time is to get your answers to a few questions. And finally, a test close. In your opinion, do you feel? Now, how you say, not what you say, makes the difference. So think about these things, but forget about them, and certainly don't try to fit yourself into them. But think about them and just incorporate any of them if it makes sense. The law of reciprocation is when someone says no, it begins a process of them wanting to say yes. So keep that in mind. This comment applies more to direct sales of products, the progressive test close. If you want to go ahead, then when would you want to start? To align with what you're showing and selling with their benefits. A test or trial close is a way of telling throughout the process where someone is rather than waiting until the end. You know, if you were to participate in this seminar, what would you most want to get out? The task of sales is the science of persuasion. The questions you ask people determine what they focus on. I'm being redundant here because these are the important points I really want you to take away. Because at any time, we're only focusing on a small band of data, what's available to us. Our brains are like a camera, and we only see what we focus on. If you can get the person to stop focusing on whether or not they're going to do something and focus on, let's say for a moment you were going to do mentor coaching with me or take my seminar or training, when would you want to do it? Then they're focusing on buying and adding emotion to the new experience of a new choice and are more likely to focus on moving forward. It gives them a chance to have a trial experience. Buying means pleasure. Not buying means pain. When it feels real, it's emotional. And our imagination is 10 times more powerful than our will. Fear is the number one reason that stops action. So learn how to utilize imagination to make it real for people and paint it vividly. Ask questions. When you ask a question, it changes what somebody focuses on. Whenever somebody's focused on negative reasons, ask a question and they'll forget what their negative flow is. So make it real and assume the sale. When people don't buy, it's because they've linked buying with more pain than not buying. When people do buy, they link buying with more pleasure than not buying. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. Now, let's talk about converting objections into commitments. If somebody has an objection, rather than ignore it or talk around it, you want to know specifically what it is. An objection equates to asking for more information. You hear the reframe here? Don't be put off by it. The best salespeople average 5 objections before a conversation. And be sure that an objection is not the projected voice of you, the seller. So an objection does 3 things. So you want to welcome an objection. It does 3 things. Provides the opportunity to hear the primary concern. It crystallizes it so that you can address it and reframe it. Secondly, it's an opportunity to understand the person's belief or fear. And third, it's the strongest opportunity to get the real reason. An objection is a question in disguise. Objections are signposts, your resources. So the best way to respond to an objection is to take each objection and interpret it as a question. Rather than a reason for not buying, reframe it to a question to request more information. I can't afford this. Means, please show me how I can afford it so it's worth it. I have to talk it over with somebody else. This means, please give me enough reason so I can go ahead and buy it without having to check and get someone else's opinion. Welcome an objection because it's information. It's a stepping stone to success. Treat an objection as powerful and important. Perhaps even compliment the objection as a good question, if it is, because it allows both sides to think about it and address it. A mistake is to fight the objection. The key to influence is to align with the person. Remember that? In spite of the fear, what will be the benefit, the greater benefit of doing it? If the answer is yes in their gut, they will proceed. Some considerations to convert objections into commitments. 1, don't engage the objection by countering it. Remember, focus directs attention. Secondly, hear them out. 3, feed it back as a question. It puts the objection back to the questioner, who then has to explain. Often when somebody tries to explain an objection, they'll withdraw it. 3, get more information. What's the real objection? 5, align with the prospect to collaborate. In a collaboration, you're on the same side. You're both in the circle. If you fight an objection, it will limit you. Don't counter the question or the objection. An alignment would be, I appreciate and respect how you feel about that. 6, turn the objection into a question. Reframe it. Questions generate focus. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. Well, that brings up a question. It seems the real question is, can you get enough value to justify buying it? Or it sounds like the real question is, how can you get benefits now? Focus on the benefit rather than the concern. For example, if there's an issue with expense, reframe it. Brag about it. Do it up front. 7, answer the question. 8, assume the sale. The best persuaders assume the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision. Don't thank them for the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision. The congratulations focuses on a wise decision. Now, I want to focus on 2 more things. 1 is the psychology of closing. This is the point that both the salesperson and the prospect hate the most. In a study of seasoned salespeople, 66% after a very successful presentation forgot to ask for the sale. Do the close as quickly and painlessly as possible. Here's an example. A man had a painful tooth that he knew needed to be extracted. He called his dentist, whose patient he had been for a long time. The two knew each other really well. He asked the dentist how much he would charge him to extract a tooth and how long it would take. Well, the dentist said, well, I'll charge you $185 and it'll only take a minute. The man responded, only a minute? That's a lot of money for just a minute. And the dentist said, well, if time is an issue, I can take as long as you want. Have your closings prepared in advance, planned in advance, word for word. But and this is, I would say, the recommendation at the end of a sample session, if you do sample session. There'll come a time when you won't need to do sample session. But your recommendation will come at the end of a discussion, a brief discussion about coaching. Sound natural, spontaneously, like you're talking, not reading a script. Some major requirements for closing. Be positive, eager, and enthusiastic. The customer's requirements must be clear. The customer must understand what you are offering and value it, which is what you found out from asking questions. The customer must feel rapport, friendship, and trust. They must know and find benefit in what they will get. And the product or service needs to be suited for the prospect. So these are the four aspects. Prospects must want it, need it, afford it, and use it. So some closing strategies, and there are about a half dozen, maybe seven. Never tell a client he's wrong. A man convinced his will is of the same opinion still. Go with the objection, indicating it's a valid concern, then engage in the message and the benefit. Get third-party proof, someone else who has had a similar objection, saying how it worked and glad that they made the purchase, or reference them. Don't knock the competition. Sell the value and the benefit of your product. Don't engage in personal issues with the client. Don't assume authority you don't have, promises you can't keep, or overselling. And avoid negative expectations, such as deciding the person won't buy. Remember, the hero is the person, place, product, or brand that enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. How can you make your client the hero of his or her story? So the final thing, to make it easy and create a future. Create a relationship that lasts through the years. The most important part of the sale is to generate a relationship. Create a lifetime relationship and referral reciprocity. Give additional value than what is expected. Tie it down so there's no buyer's remorse. To prevent buyer's remorse, consider future pacing. Future pace every time somebody purchases. Have buyers imagine themselves in the future. Ways they will use the product in the future. A year from now, what will you be doing with this training that will make you glad you've done it? Link something present to your product. I build this into the training of mentor coaches. When I do New Life Story Wellness Coaches Training or New Money Story Mentor Training, we do a quarterly mentor group in a white paper that I send them. For corporate mentoring programs, I do a monthly mentor group teleconference for 12 months and build a specific continued learning topic around that. Give your clients a reason to buy. Theirs, not yours. Emotional and logical. Both components are important in the purchase. We buy emotionally, justify logically. If we can't justify it logically, we're not going to buy something. People will put off buying if they can. So build units of conviction. Make it fun. Laugh. Create state changes. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have I said that before? And finally, some strategies of successful people, top sellers. A 6-point summary of what we do. 1, we affect our own emotional state. Reset after the last experience. A number one quality. We prepare ourselves physically and emotionally. The number two strategy of successful people, top sellers. Qualify prospect. Find their deepest needs, their core emotional need that drives them, a pain, a hurt, a challenge. Then teach them how to get that through what you offer. This is how you can change a segment of the world, dealing consistently with people who have changes that haven't been able to do or be something themselves, and you offer them in collaboration a way to transcend that. That's huge. You're making a difference in someone's life, that may be the most change-making agent in that person's life, adult life, at least ever. Three, manage the client's state. And that first of all means, of course, you have to manage your state. Four, give prospects a way to justify buying, to justify getting what you have to satisfy the need. Five, successful salespeople are flexible. The person most flexible controls the situation. To be successful, know the outcome, take action, know what getting closer and getting farther away looks like. Change the approach until you get what you want. And six, become a team player, consistently attuned to the client's needs. Is there more value than the concern they bring? Create and sustain interest. Build trust and rapport continuously. Now, I want to have a brief discussion, but I also want to say how much I value your input and your responses. It's been a total privilege and pleasure putting this together for you. I've learned a great deal, and I've benefited from your input and your questions and the kinds of things that you mentioned in the beginning of what you hoped you'd get out of it. So I appreciate that very much. I'm going to move us to discussion mode, and if you would manage the background noise, if you're on a, especially on a cell phone or computer phone, do a star six to mute and unmute. Again, star six when you're ready to talk. So we're in discussion mode. What kind of questions and things would you like to talk about? What is, and you look at these four seminars, what is the most important thing that you've learned during these four seminars? Is there one thing that stands out that might make a difference that for you right now seems the most important thing that you've learned? What do you first think of?
Confidence.
Yes, okay, great.
Clarity.
Okay. And the reason I asked for the first thing, I did this at one of the What's Next exec retreats, and this is a group of very successful people, CEOs, business owners, and I asked them, I'm going to ask you a question, and I would like you to write down, I want it concrete and tangible, the first thing that comes to your mind about this question, meaning I want an emotional response. I don't want them to process it logically and come up with some convoluted thing. And I asked them, what is your unlived life? And every one of them was astonished. They said that was the most poignant moment that they had in that entire 2.5 days because they responded emotionally instantly. Could I get a management of the background noise to mute, please, so we could continue discussion? Thank you, I hope. So I appreciate that response. Other responses about what has been most meaningful to you or the thing you learned that has the most impact potentially in this series? Anyone? Well, let me move to any questions or clarification. We've got just about 1 minute. Any questions or clarification about anything that we talked about that you'd like to have a very brief discussion about?
I have a question.
Yes.
I confess that I haven't listened to last week's lecture yet. I had intended to.
Well, you're in for a treat.
Drew, I know. I'm looking forward to it. I'm wondering if it would be appropriate to email any questions I might have following
sure.
that.
Sure. Absolutely. You have my email address from the things I've sent around, and most recently, earlier today, the chart. So, yeah, email a question if you have it. Absolutely. And if you have any other thoughts or reflections about what you heard or any comments about it, I'd love to hear from you. So thank you all again very, very much. I really appreciate it. And I would be eager to hear from you and to see what you think about this. So thanks very, very much. It's been a privilege. Bye now. To be continued.